Good morning to everybody. This is the first time I've ever spoken in this forum, although I'm not shy to speak. It's a slightly different forum than that which I normally address. What do I have to bring to this esteemed conference of educators and educationalists, if you like? The following maybe, and in this respect you may feel, oh, well, this guy, what does he know, he's not even American, he's coming from a different culture, from a different perspective, from a very kind of staid and conservative English culture, except that English has suddenly become revolutionaries in the last few days, so maybe our time is yet to come. On the other hand, maybe you have another perspective to bring, which may be helpful in some way, and can influence the way we think about failure, which is what I want to talk about today. Let me give you a little bit of personal background. I'm not going to repeat what was just said, but I grew up in the late 70s and 80s. That was my formative years. I was born in 68. So I was at a private school, a fee-paying private school, which was an entry exam school, so the kids were pretty bright, and you couldn't get in there unless you had a certain base level. I went through that schooling. It was a non-Jewish school, but a very large proportion of the people in the school were Jewish, 20-25%. After I left school, I went to university. I was at the same university as Sarah. We were both at Oxford University, and obviously Oxford University is not a place full of people who are, idiots, but there were plenty of people there who were not so bright in many different ways. But we both did law degrees at Oxford University, and I went on then to become a lawyer before I, as I mentioned yesterday, gave up the profits of the law for the law of the profits, and decided to stop being a lawyer and give full-time shiurim. Even when I was a lawyer, I taught quite a lot, gave shiurim here and there, but then I went into full-time. And then for the last 12 years, really I've been teaching in Eretz Yisrael, most intensively in the last 10 years, and I teach about 35, 40 hours a week. It's quite really a full-time job. Mostly young women, mostly Americans, okay, a few Canadians and a few Brits sprinkled in, but mostly young 18, 19-year-old American women, and also Baalot Teshuva as well, age 22, 23, but again, mostly Americans. And one of the things that shocked me as I came into this system, which was very foreign to me, first of all, in certain schools, I hasten to add, not in MNY, I was told to grade the students. And I said, well, how am I meant to grade them? They didn't do any tests. Oh, just grade them on the basis that they came. Really? Yes, if they came, they should get an A. And if they didn't come, then they should not. They should maybe get a B or a C or something like that. And this was very strange to me, as I'm sure it is quite strange to you as well. But some schools told me that. But then I went to more academically focused schools, and I was told, no, God forbid, you can't grade people on the basis they just turned up. Of course they're meant to turn up. You have to set them a proper test. Okay, so I'm meant to set them a test. Now, the girls expect to get A's. Meaning, if you get B's, I'm sure you're all aware in the culture that you come from, that is not acceptable. You have to get A's, right? An A minus, maybe. An occasional B. But you have to get A's. Okay, you have to get A's. So what's the A grade? 92%. 92%. That my class has to get A's, otherwise they feel as though their life's falling apart. That means they have to get 92% in all the exams that I set. Well, how can I set a proper exam if everybody's getting 92% in the exam? I have to set a Mickey Mouse exam in order to allow them to get 92%, to get the A grade that they expect. What kind of a test is that? That's not a test. That's just massaging their ego. And therefore, I refuse to do that. I'll tell you soon what I actually do. On the other hand, they have to get their A's, otherwise they really will fall apart. But I had a different system and a different approach, and it got me thinking about a lot of these things. I don't think it's a surprise to anybody in this room that we're very, very nervous about our children failing. This wasn't the case when I was a child, and I'm not recommending the English upbringing that I had for everybody or even anybody. Frankly, I was told quite often that I was a failure by many, many people. I was told it's not that you have an inferiority complex, you're just inferior in many respects. This was something I was told constantly in university, that I was doing okay, but I had no flair and no special talent for the topic. But okay, you're doing fine. This is not something I suggest feeding our kids, But it does point out a very important thing, which is, and I brought you just four or five sources here, that failure is a critical part of chinuch. And by stopping our children experiencing failure and the disappointments of failure and the disappointment that they didn't perform and that they have to do better, we are depriving them of an absolutely critical educational experience, which is not then giving them the tools that when they do inevitably fail, meaning 92%, really, are 92% of our tefillahs A-grade tefillahs? We really achieve that? Are 92% of our Bein Adam L'Chaveru interactions correct? Inevitably, we don't hit that in real life, and therefore we have no tools to be able to deal with that inevitable failure, given that we've never been allowed to fail in the past. And I want to bring you just 6 sources that deal with this kind of idea, and then I brought you a few examples and a few studies, and then I'll tell you where I'm coming from and what I actually practically suggest. First of all, in terms of bouncing back, the idea of things not going right the first time and having to be done again is built into our system. Just look at the first couple of sources. This is a source about a midrash about the creation of the world. Rabbi Yehuda bar Siman, Yehi Erev Ein Ksiv Kan. It doesn't say Yehi Erev Yehi Boker. Ela Vayehi Erev. And it was evening. Why is there an and? What came before the creation of the world that it says Vayehi Erev? Amar Rabbi Avu Malamid Shehaya Boirei Olamas Umachriva. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was creating worlds and then rubbing them out and destroying them, whatever this means midrashically. Ad Shebara Et Eino, until this world was eventually created. Ama, and he said, Din Hainan, this world, I like this world, this world is right for me. Yatom Loi Hainan, the other ones didn't work. The other ones were failures on some level, and therefore I had to rub them out, and they were not up to scratch. Amar Rav Pinchas Tameid Rabbi Avo, Vayar Elokim Es Kal Asher Asa V'Hinei Tov Ma'od. Eventually, this world is created and it's Tov Ma'od. Why? Again, Dein Hanainli. This one is right. This one worked. Yatam Loi Hanain. The whole world is created on the understanding that Kodesh Baruch Hu, whatever this means, was creating worlds that just didn't work. Just didn't work until eventually the one was created that did work. What it means to say that Hashem, if you like, failed in this sense is a good question. But I think it's meant to be telling us this idea that before you can succeed, there have to be many opportunities to fail. Look at number 2, again a classic in Mishlei, Kisheva Yipol Tzadik Vakam, 7 times the Tzadik falls but gets up, Urishayim Yikashlu Bara'ah, but a Rosha will fall and not be able to get up because of his evil. And the Matsudas David says, why is it Kisheva Yipol Tzadik? He af im tzaddik neufel sheva pa'amim. Even though the tzaddik fails 7 times, yachzor v'yakam, he gets up again and tries again and again. Aval harashayim heima nichshalim mibli tkuma, they fail. A rosha will fail without the ability to rise. B'var lehem ara, when anything bad happens, the rosha immediately falls apart and fails. And therefore, the idea of bouncing back is very important. It's laid into the whole fabric of the Bria in that sense. And more than that, it is actually the assumption of our Gemara. When we learn Gemara, think of the number of shitas. Think of the number of opinions that fail in the sense that they never make it into the final halacha. You know, I was once giving a shir to girls early on when I was teaching Gemara, and I was going through different shitas, and I said, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, we never paskin like him in this issue. And one girl in the back said, oh, that's so sad. And I said, yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's not meant to be an emotional exercise, but understand that the whole point is, yes, most people in the Gemara never make it into the halacha. That's not considered that they like failed in some sense when they're looking from Shemayim, whatever. I don't think that's how we view the exercise. But it's more than this. That failure is not just something we need to overcome, it's actually a source of success. Look at number 3 and 4. Number 3 is a pasuk in Micha. Al tisvachi oyavti li, ki nafalti. Don't be happy, those who are enemies of mine, because I fall. Because ki nafalti kamti. Because I fell, I was able to rise. Ki eshev b'choshev, because I sit in the dark, Hashem orali. God is a light for me. And the Midrash Tehillim says, in number 4, Ilmale nafalti, if it wasn't for the fact that I was able to fall, loikamti, I could never have arisen. And Ilmale yashavti, if it wasn't for the fact that I sat b'choshek in the dark, loihaya orli. There is no light without having experienced the dark. And in truth, in modern companies, in some high-tech, innovative companies, when they're trying to encourage people to be creative, to invent new things, and this is something that happens in the real workplace, they have to give people a culture that it doesn't matter if you fail. Nobody's going to blame you, and you're not meant to blame yourself, because it's the fear of failing that will stop people being creative and actually produce the things we need. And therefore, there are companies in which it's a culture. Failure is not a bad thing. The more you fail, the more likely you are to eventually be innovative and succeed. And the last two sources I brought before I get onto a discussion of the Lemaisa are issues of overprotection. We're sometimes incredibly overprotective. There have been many articles about this, about kids don't get the chance to play in real playgrounds. The playgrounds are all sanitized so that no one can hurt themselves. It's only the potential to hurt yourself that makes it fun to play there in reality. And yet, you know, obviously we don't want to introduce our children to danger, but we're all aware and we all lament the fact that, oh, we grew up in an age where we could this and we could that, and now our kids are wrapped up in cotton wool. This is a real point, hashgraphically as well. Look at number five, this idea of being able to let people experience it for themselves without trying to coddle them and closet them in this cotton wool. Vayehi b'yom ha-shishi, laktu lahem mishnah, okay? Shnei ha-oyme le-echad. On the sixth day, they all collected the man, and they collected double. V'yavol kol nesi'i ha-eidah v'yagidu le-moshe, and they all ran to Moshe and said, what's going on? And he said to them, this is a Shabbaton, machar. Tomorrow is going to be the Shabbat. Bake whatever you need to bake. Cook whatever you need to cook. Why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu tell them at the beginning, when he was told by God that they would get double the portion on Friday? He keeps that from them. He doesn't give them that information. He allows them to experience the getting the double portion and then running to him and saying, what's going on? Why is this happening? Look at the Rashbam, he says, Moshe niskaven, he intended shiu tamim, that they should be surprised and they shouldn't be prepared. Being prepared will be bad for them. Because sheyimsu mishnah, when they find the double portion, they should be surprised. Lohadia lahem ata kvoid l'shal yom haShabbos, that they will experience firsthand kavod Shabbos. Shabbos is something that has to be experienced, and this first exercise, if you like, of finding the double portion is not. If he deliberately didn't give them the information, and he allowed them to find it for themselves. And the last source here on number six that I brought, Amar Rebbe Eloi, B'Shem Rebbe Yossi Ben Zimra, L'Pnima Loi Gila HaKadosh Baruch Hu La'Avram Avinu She'yiten Le'banav Es Haman. Why didn't Avram Avinu ever give why didn't Hashem give Avram Avinu the message that they would indeed receive the man at some stage? Why wasn't there a Masorah? Oh, one day we're going to get the man. One day it's going to be okay. One day it's all going to be fine. And the Medra says an astounding thing. She'ilu gila oisoy lahem. Because if this had been a tradition, that the Jewish people were one day going to get that man, Hayu Yisrael oimrim, that when they eventually got the man, they would have said, ah, kvar achalnu ota al shulchan shel paro. We already ate this. This is nothing new. Ah, this is not the real thing. What does that mean, we already ate it with paro? The fact that they expected that it was coming meant that when it eventually came, it didn't mean anything. Very interesting source. Your expectation that you are going to get the A makes the A totally meaningless. And the expectation that you are going to get the man would have taken all of the specialness out of the man. Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz talks about this in one of his essays, which I referenced at the bottom. There are many sources. I just brought you these about the importance of bouncing back, about the importance of failure as a source of success, and the importance of not over-closeting and over-preparing people and allowing them to experience for themselves. I brought you at the bottom because we are in America, after all. The story of Abraham Lincoln, which I think makes interesting reading. Every single step of the way, he was knocked back. His family was forced out of their home. His mother died. He failed in business. He constantly lost. He couldn't get into law school. He borrowed money to end the business and went bankrupt. He spent most of his life paying off the debt. He ran for the state legislature, eventually won, but then he got engaged and his wife to be died, and he was brokenhearted. He had a nervous breakdown. He was in bed for 6 months. He tried to be the speaker of the state legislature and he lost. He sought to become the elector and he lost. He ran for Congress and he lost. He ran for Congress and then he won. Then he ran for re-election and he lost. He sought a job at the land office and he was rejected. He ran for the Senate and he lost. He sought to be the vice president nomination. He got less than 100 votes. Eze Busha, he completely flunked out. He ran for the Senate again and he lost. And then he was elected president of the United States of America. Okay? Abraham Lincoln would have been excused for saying, you know something, I got a sparkle who's trying to tell me something. Okay? I am a loser, that's how it is. And the answer is no. Because he fell down, he got back up again. This is a very important lesson I think we need to explain to our children. I brought you two articles here, which I got. One of them is an American article, and one of them is an English article. The first one is an American article, and it's about sports. Okay, which doesn't mean a lot to me because I don't understand American sports, and I didn't even know the Super Bowl was football. Was it football? Football, right? I thought it was baseball. I didn't even know. Whatever. I'm just a loser on this. But it's about sports, and it's written by the psychologist here, Laura Meal. I don't know exactly who she is, but it was written up, and I gave you the reference here. Look at what she writes. Look at the second paragraph. It talks about her daughter. Let's start from the beginning. Contrary to what one would think, having everyone a winner mentality in my daughter's youth softball league did not come as good news to me. I actually labeled this talk, almost have prizes, question mark. This is a title of a book by someone called Melanie Phillips, someone interesting in England on the right wing of the, if you like, educational political spectrum. She wrote this book about 20 years ago about this cult culture of everybody has to have prizes and everyone has to be rewarded. Rabbi Sacks actually described her book as, this is likely to become the most discussed work of social criticism since Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind. Which is interesting, I didn't mean that as a dig. But the book is definitely worth reading. So here, back on page 2, it says as follows. On one particular occasion, my daughter was running from second to third base and was thrown out. Typically, the girls are allowed to stay on the base, even if they're out. I refused, and I insisted that my daughter follow more competitive rules. I explained to her why she was out. I view this as confronting a small but important failure. I understand that this might sound harsh to some parents, but I grasp the psychological significance that failure can play in sports and wanted my daughter to perceive this lesson as well. The next time she has to run to bases, she ran like her hair was on fire. She did not want to get thrown out again. Children need to be taught that the rules are what the rules are and why they are thrown out. They cannot always be not thrown out. It is becoming commonplace to give every child a trophy just for showing up or to change the rules of the game to avoid any sort of failure. But this mindset goes against the fundamentals on which sports were built. Beyond the scope of sports, however, these changes are disadvantageous to children in the long term. It deprives children of valuable learning lessons, coping skills that will extend into other facets of their life. If they're not taught how to work harder in order to accomplish their goals, and instead expect that success will be handed to them, you will get your A and you will get your 92%, then what is the point of hard work and dedication? Children will not be able to apply those same valuable principles to other aspects of their life, such as achieving good grades, securing scholarships, or working towards a better job. And she goes on about this further. Look at the last paragraph. Although I believe that advocates for everyone's a winner approach have good intentions, I do not agree with the way that they are trying to accomplish it. We need to empower children and instill confidence while allowing them to experience a valuable lesson in life, failure. The world is full of competition. By diluting the competitive nature of sports, we risk stifling a child's future and development in more ways than one. And I brought you then on the top of the next page an article from The Guardian, which is a British newspaper, by another psychologist and associate fellow of the British Psychological Society. And he writes this about A-levels. Now, you guys might not know what A-levels are. We'll talk a little bit about the British system in a minute. But A-levels are the exams you take at the end of 12th grade. A-levels are incredibly stressful. I was having recurring nightmares about failing my A-levels for about 7 years after I was 18. And I'm not joking, I really was. I didn't fail them, I passed them, but it was so stressful. My degree itself, I'll explain to you what my degree was, I'll come back to it in a minute. I did a degree in law at Oxford University. It was a 3-year degree because most of the English degrees are 3 years. There was no ongoing coursework. There were no modules. I had exams just to check I was still alive and functioning in March of my first year, which did not count in any way to my degree. They were just to check that I was still there. And my next exam and my entire degree were based on 10 essays written in May of my final year in 1 week. That was it, the entire degree. That's called pressure, okay? And that was what we were expected to deal with. Have a look at what he says in 8 here. We all want our children to succeed, don't we? What many of us overlook, however, is that allowing them to fail is an important part of any future success. Note, this man's a teacher as well, that I've no issue with the use of the oft-derided term fail, for without failure there will be no success, would there? Fail is not a popular word in education. I was also surprised, by the way, when a girl doesn't do a test, meaning she didn't do the test at the end of the semester, in seminary or whatever, I was told in many places I'm not allowed to give her a fail on the grade. I have to give her an incomplete. Why do I have to give her an incomplete? It's not incomplete. It's a fail. She didn't do the test. Why should she be incomplete and not be allowed to be told that she's failed? Because it'll look bad, whatever. That's difficult for me to understand. Even if you failed your A-levels and you would still be awarded an unclassified, it's as if the word itself would make failure inevitable. Of course, athletes know how to deal with failure because they have a greater understanding of their own personal psychology, which in turn leads to greater mental strength to add to their obvious physical strength and a higher level of psychological resilience. Many of us, both pupils and those involved in education, remain relatively ignorant of the link between psychology and success. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not prepared to speak about psychology. That's not my field. Assuming that, for example, our intelligence is a fixed, innate, and unchangeable quantity. In fact, adolescent intelligence, as measured by IQ scores, fluctuates considerably, leading Angela Duckworth, etc., etc., to conclude that academic success is more to do with motivation and grit than being born bright. If success is within our personal control, then the way in which we praise pupils should reflect that view. Praising innate abilities, you're very clever, leads to a fixed mindset, and he goes on about praising hard work, etc. In the end, he says a very English thing. He says, so let's hear it for failure. You're just one more step on the road to success. Okay? You're a failure, shkoyach. So what should we do about this? Meaning, yes.
Can I ask a question about it?
Yes, of course.
So we're talking about failure, we're talking about success, but no one ever talks about mediocrity.
Okay.
Which also exists in most of our lives in many areas.
By definition, most people are averagely mediocre.
Yeah, except for those areas where we are very successful or that we failed at. There's all that in between. And there are two books that were written, I forget the name of the author, but Blessings of Skin Me, about young children and
right.
What it means to fall and pick oneself up.
Okay.
And then she goes on, once she has teenage kids, to write Blessings of a B-. Because life is about balancing. You're not just...
Right, so that's exactly the point I want to come on to now, the blessings of the
B-.
So
that's my point. We're talking about failure, but it isn't always about failure.
Good.
Most of the time, it's about kids being told not good enough.
So here's my suggestion. You're exactly segueing into the final part of what I'm saying. I'm to finish in about 5 minutes, so let's talk about that now. That's exactly what I'm coming on to. I brought you here at the bottom of page 3 a standard United States grading system, which is what I'm certainly familiar with, what I've been given, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is pretty standard, that A plus is 95%, A is 93%, etc., etc., and by the time you hit fail, it's 59%, okay? And no one wants to be getting C's and D's, etc. In some places, go over to page 4 for a second, there are slightly other systems. In California, they have a sort of grade stroke mark where 4 is advanced, exceeds standards, that's 90 to 100, 80 to 89 is meet standards, 70 to 79 is partially proficient, and 0 to 69 is not proficient. 69 is not proficient, okay? You have failed. 69, you are not proficient. Look at the standard UK university grading system in number 11. A first-class degree. Now, I was at university. Okay, I was with some clever people. Almost nobody got a first-class degree. If you wanted to be an academic, you had to get a first-class degree because you needed that extra flair. Most people, they worked hard and they get what's called an upper second-class degree. First class is 70% plus, and an upper second is 60 to 69. That means the highest level, except for the exceptional people, were getting 60 to 69%, were told that they were doing okay, as opposed to not proficient. I brought you in number 12, which I couldn't resist, something from a don. A don is just a posh English word for a professor at Oxford and Cambridge, a professor of classics in Newnham College in Cambridge University. Now, without getting into all the very strange, I went to a school that was very like Hogwarts, and it really, really was. We had warden, we had prefects wearing long black gowns, and when I was a head boy, and we had this and we had that, we had houses and points. We really did. She didn't make any of that up. Mama, she did not. Anyone who's English will know this is exactly how it really is, or at least how it was, okay? Except we didn't have girls in the school. That was unthinkable. It was just a boys' school. But one of the peculiarities about Oxford and Cambridge is they're not prepared to give you A's and B's. They have to give you alphas and betas. Because they have to speak in Greek because it's Oxford and Cambridge. Okay? But they don't just give you alphas and betas. They have a strange system where they give you alpha treble plus or alpha double plus, alpha plus, then alpha, and then alpha beta, and then alpha minus, alpha double. They have this crazy system of pluses and minuses, and combining alphas and betas and alphas, it all equates to grades. Look at what she says. Take, for example, a mark at the very top of the two ones. That was where I was at university. Say 69. Now, she says, a 69 could be given to a paper that was consistently very good. Consistently very good. Right across the board. But didn't ever show that kind of extra flair that you would expect in a first. Or it could be given to a paper that was much more mixed, with definite bits of first-class work, but pulled down by less good work. If you want to indicate that it's 69, you give it a B to treble plus. Meaning, what I wanted to get out of this is that 69 is, quotes, consistently very good right across the board. Now, what is 69 here? Not proficient. I want to suggest that it may well be that we're missing a real opportunity here. Now, I can't suggest that everyone in the Jewish school starts grading their papers in an English style, otherwise no one's going to get into university anywhere in America, right? But maybe even in coding, there is a miler, there is an advantage, and with this I'll finish, there is an advantage for telling people, look, you got 69. If I give 69% to most of my students, they're totally devastated. But there is a miler for telling them, look, you got 69, it was a difficult test. You should be aware that 30% of it you're failing in, meaning there's a long way for you to go. But 69 is okay. 69 is pretty good across the board. Just no flair. Everybody has to have flair. If everybody has to have flair, nobody has flair. Okay? Therefore, I think there is a strong educational message for giving our kid the A at 70. By the way, when I'm marking tests, I don't care what anybody tells me. 70% is an A minus, 80% is an A, 90% is an A plus. Okay? But they'll get an A minus for 70% because I want them to understand that there's 30% of it that you got wrong. You need to do better. You need to work harder. But you shouldn't be punished for feeling that you got 30% wrong. And I don't know whether there's any way that this can be worked into the system of how people are grading that. And maybe in some areas where it doesn't make a difference to the SATs or something, to at least give that message that failure is an essential part of building yourself a success from a Jewish Hashgraphic perspective. And maybe we should be allowing our kids to fail more in order to build themselves more in the future. Just a suggestion from a strange Englishman as to how that works. Do with it what you wish. Any questions? Yes, sir.
I think that if you look at the American system, the problem really is much, much deeper. Because in the American system, it's really about finance, about money, about getting a job, about getting at that top law school to get that top job at a top law firm. It's also about not allowing kids, young people, to really do what, you know, what their heart's calling really is. If you don't get into a top college, you look bad to the neighbors. Everybody's watching you.
It's fine, and we have to play the game.
What is wrong? Yeah, but you know, it's more than just the game. There are very, very fine, community colleges that, you know, have excellent coursework. God forbid somebody should go to a community college.
Right, I understand. We've upped the stakes. That's true in England as well. And we can't go against that grain, otherwise our kids won't get into college. We have to be in the system that we're in. But maybe there's some other way in our educational system we can still feed this message, even though it's not going to cause them to lose that job that they need to get.
But it's not about that. It's academics against vocation. There are young people excellent at what they do. They could be phenomenal. And yet,
correct,
if they don't have that intellectual degree...
Correct. There are far too many people at university. There's no question about it. There are far too many universities, and there's far too many people going to university. And if you don't go to university, it's... We were talking to someone at the Shabbos table yesterday. Our kids grew up in Israel. There's a very, very little, small chance that my daughter will go to university. That's not because she's not bright or because she's not. It's because she doesn't need to go to university. There are a million other places that she can go to get a meaningful and appropriate job. And there are very few universities in Israel, and they're not for her. And now in America, if I said my daughter's not going to go to college, it's like, you know, social suicide. Yes.
But if we take it down to our
firm
world, the fact that we don't have firm trade schools, the fact that Gemara is the be-all and end-all for every boy, whether he's equipped to
These are all questions which are true, but they're beyond what I'm talking about.
But it's part of the failure. They're failing because they're not being given the education that would probably work for them. You know, we talk about Yonachanar Kidarko. It's not about not failing. It's about which direction is this child supposed to be going, and are you giving him what he needs?
You're 100% right.
To get to success.
All I'm suggesting is a very minor adjustment in at least people's understanding of what failure and success is. We can't change the entire system of how we teach tomorrow and how we have vocational training, community colleges. We can't change that tomorrow. But we can at least change people's understanding that they have to get 92 and they have to be an A+ in all things, otherwise they're a complete failure and they fall apart. There are small ways that we can introduce that, and maybe that will help people. And maybe that will change something in the long term, but that we can't do. I have to end because our time is up. Thank you very much.